But first, Daniel Tammet. He's been described as the most remarkable mind on the planet, and one of the world's 100 living geniuses. Tammet lives with what's called high-functioning autistic savant syndrome. His new book is Embracing the Wide Sky, A Tour Across the Horizons of the Mind. In the book, Tammet writes that Oliver Sacks' famous account of autistic savant twins has led to some misconceptions about autistic savants. Many people see them as freaks of nature. But as Daniel Tammet told Steve Paulson, autistic minds are really not that different.
I think, first of all, what is important to say is that my humanity makes the abilities that I have possible. I find numbers and words beautiful. There is a quality to the shapes and the colors that I associate with words and numbers and language and so on that makes them beautiful. And I think it's the same quality that a musician hears when he listens to Mozart, or when someone walking into a gallery sees the Mona Lisa or some of the landscapes painted by some of these great artists, Gauguin and so on. It's the same quality that poets try to put into their work. And what I argue is that this quality of thinking with beauty at its center is fundamentally human. It's something that's shared by everyone. And as a result, the intuitions that I think savants have for things like numbers and words and so on, these don't come out of robotic computer-like processes in the brain. These come out of intuitions that are shared by everyone.
You are perhaps most famous for reciting over 22,000 digits of pi from memory, but certainly just an extraordinary feat, which took you over 5 hours to do. Do you have a photographic memory?
I don't, no. And again, that's one of the myths that I push back against in the book. I think it's important to make it clear that, you know, my mind isn't perfect. I make mistakes. But what's important is that, you know, the qualities that govern my thinking, intuition, creativity, love, emotion, positive, you know, very strong emotions, that these are very human things, and these are things that are shared by everyone, and these are things that anyone can draw on in terms of how they learn, how they teach their children. So this is a very positive, inclusive message of intelligence and of thinking, about thinking and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have a photographic memory, how did you go about remembering those 22,000 digits of pi? I mean, how did you prepare for being able to recite all those numbers in public?
Well, what I describe in the book is how I think of numbers as shapes and colors and textures, and specifically as semantic shapes. What I mean by that is that these shapes have meanings that are derived from their relationships to other shapes. And I give an example which is one that everyone can relate to, and that is thinking about the word giraffe. If you think of the word giraffe for a moment, very much unconsciously and spontaneously, you'll think of an animal. You'll think of an animal that is very tall and one that has a very distinctive neck. And if you were trying to describe a giraffe to somebody else, you would need these words, you would need these concepts to be able to talk about it at all. And all of this is, as I say, it happens instantly, and it happens in pictures. You think in pictures of this animal and how it looks and the concepts that make it a giraffe. And when I'm thinking of different numbers, like 37 or 23 or whatever the number would be, 37, for example, it's a very lumpy number, like porridge, like oatmeal. And so because I can picture the numbers in the same way that you can picture a giraffe, I can pick out visually the things, the qualities, the characteristics that make it meaningful, that give it its meaning by relating it to other pictures that I have for other numbers.
So numbers for you have a certain shape. Do they have color as well? And do they have size?
Yes, very often the numbers will have sizes. 6, for example, is a very, very small number, whereas 9 would be a much larger number. And colors, certainly as well. 3 would be a green number. 5 would be yellow. 11 would be a very bright, shiny number. So these qualities, again, help me to make sense of them, help me to relate them to other numbers. And so they form a web of meaning in my mind that helps me to make sense of them and to do calculations. And what I argue in the book, and it's a very interesting point, I think, that the instincts that I have for numbers are shared to some extent by everyone. Everyone is born scientists now know, with an accounting instinct, the ability to, for example, look at four objects and not need to count them, be able to look at them and know immediately that there are four of whatever the object is. And so this suggests that there are certain very basic numbers that have kind of like qualities in the human mind, and we're born with that ability. And an arithmetic and mathematics and all of that which comes later is built on those instincts. I think the problem is that in schools we generally teach in such a way that we kind of take all of the enthusiasm and all of the imagination and all of the intuition out of mathematics. And I think this is what makes people so scared of numbers and trying to do sums and things like this.
And so if you're saying that for you, this whole world of numbers is just incredibly beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, beauty is, as I said, a fundamental part of how I think. It's interesting that people like Albert Einstein, for example, when he was figuring out the laws of relativity and so on, used pictures in his mind as well to come up with those big ideas and described them as beautiful. He knew that they were correct, not because he'd done very rigorous calculations, but even before the calculations were finished, he could tell that this made sense, that this was right in some way, because it was so beautiful, it had to be right. I think this is a big way that people would learn language as well. If you're a very young child, you learn a language very easily. You don't have to have verb tables and grammar books. You learn your first language very, very easily at a very young age. And I do wonder, and I do put forward this theory in the book, that young children do this in part by having this kind of synesthetic sensibility that I have for numbers and words that they share as well at a very young age. Because the brain is much more like an autistic brain for everyone. When you're very small, there are lots and lots of connections in the brain that we lose as we get older. And I wonder if that extra connectivity in the brain at a very young age when we're children helps give us that amazing ability to imagine and to have fun with words and numbers and to spot those patterns and so on. And we lose that as we get older. And the good news is that we can regain a lot of that ability. We can retrain those intuitions. I don't think we ever lose those. And I give lots of exercises in the book to help readers to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also have a remarkable gift for learning languages, and you are pretty fluent in, what, a half dozen languages or so?
Yes, I know, I would say, about 12 languages. I can speak some of them fluently, others I can read pretty well. And I use a kind of thinking which is, again, similar to numbers. It's very, very associative. I will think of a word and immediately other words will spring out in my mind and form kind of like architectures of meaning, clusters of meaning. And these help to give the words a sense, of course, in my mind. And it also helps me to remember them, because it's much easier to remember a piece of information when it's connected to other pieces of information than to try to remember a long list of unconnected words.
If you were to set out to learn a new language, how long do you think that would take you?
Well, I think the classic experiment that we did for the documentary, I was given a challenge to learn Icelandic, the Icelandic language, in a few days. We were taken to the capital, Reykjavik, and I was given a tutor and several books, children's books especially. And after those few days, I was put into a studio and given a microphone, and I had to answer lots of questions, kind of similar to what we're doing now, but entirely in Icelandic on live TV. And it was pretty scary, even for me, but I managed it pretty well. And I think what the tutor said afterwards was very interesting. She said, what I found so amazing was not just that you were speaking Icelandic, but that you were creating your own words. In my book, I describe a couple of examples. One of them is the word Orfafoss, which means word waterfall. And I said, you know, this is when I'm learning a new language and I'm just submerged in this language, it's like an Orfafoss. It's like being words just falling on, tumbling onto my head in great quantity, like being under a waterfall of words. And they understood this word perfectly, and they got the sense exactly. And they were very impressed that I was able, after a few days, to actually create this word that no one had used before.
Now, there are a lot of scientists who actually do see the brain as operating basically like a computer. The artificial intelligence pioneer Marvin Minsky has famously called the brain a computer made of meat. What do you make of that analogy?
Well, I totally disagree with the analogy. I give some examples of that in the book. One of the examples I give is to talk about how different the brain is to a computer. One example would be to look at chess, for example, which computers nowadays are so fast at calculating that even the best grandmasters can no longer compete. And yet what is so interesting is that when they do play grandmasters, they think in a totally different way there. Whereas a computer like Deep Blue will calculate 250 million moves a second, clearly someone like Garry Kasparov, former world champion, doesn't think like that. What he's doing is using intuition. He's working out what moves are most likely in that situation. He's feeling out the game in the same way that I'm suggesting people could feel out a word or feel out a number. The other example is conversations, what we're having now. One of the things that, due to my autism, I found very difficult as a young child and had to consciously learn over many years. Computers are really lousy at conversations. There's the famous Turing test, which says that if ever one day a person in front of a screen could communicate with another person at distance and not realize that it's actually a computer he's talking with, then that would be the test, the real test of artificial intelligence. And every year there is a competition, and the computers get nowhere near being able to simulate human conversation. And one of the examples I give in the book is a conversation I had with the leading program for conversation, and very quickly even I could tell that this is a computer and not a human being.
Daniel Tammet is the author of Embracing the Wide Sky, A Tour Across the Horizons of the Mind. He spoke with Steve Paulson.